Okay, thank you. I'm going to turn this mic on so it should pick up my voice a little bit, but do let me know if you can't hear me, and I'll try to speak up, but I think it should work. So you can see the slide changed because I realized there was a misalignment between what was in one part of the catalogue and the brochure, so this was really what I originally pitched to Graham and the team. So this is today's subject, which is about admitting what we know and knowing what that means, exploring the types of knowledge that war games might produce. Nice bit of hedging there with might, so bear in mind I'm an academic, so hedging is our business. In this short presentation, I want to just make a few sort of claims about what I think might be going on in wargaming and some of the ways it might be improved without jettisoning its best bits, essentially. And before I start this, I want to just make a few statements just to kind of help situate where I come from this. I am a hobby wargamer. I've been playing wargames since I was a little boy. I've got a collection that I promised it would stop at 100 and I wouldn't buy any more. It's now at 187. And I also, for what it's worth, and I hope this will come through in this discussion, I do think fundamentally the way wargaming is practiced is fundamentally in the right direction. So this is a story about, you know, how can we create more precision, more defensible work, have a better sense of what war games are actually doing best and the conditions under which they can do those things best, rather than kind of be stuck endlessly in this debate about it's not a science or it is a science or it's an art, and actually how do we just move the ball forward without getting into these kind of perennial disputes. And in doing this, I do think wargaming is scientific in the broadest definition of the term, which the definition that's used by Patrick Jackson, which I just shared with somebody earlier, is that you know you have a scientific explanation of something when you could, in principle, intervene in the process and change its outcome, right? That's a very broad definition of what a scientific explanation is, but it's one in which, by understanding it in this way, you could intervene in a process and change its outcome in some way. And I think war games do that. But I think what we can do is we can get a better sense of when they what they're actually doing in some sense and lean into what they're actually doing instead of slightly more defensively claim they're doing one set of things when I think they're actually often doing a different set of things. The official position when you read the literature, and I'm also very sensitive to the fact that the distinction between the literature and the practice is often quite wide, and that when you speak to practitioners, and I have a project about this, they're often telling you a lot of really interesting and useful stuff that somehow is not appearing in the text, so that this is a kind of a based on the literature rather than what practitioners are saying. What are war games really about when you're kind of reading the literature and they're telling you this is what they're good for? They're good for studying wicked problems. They're used to evaluate or predict decisions, determine and evaluate strategies, and to generate insights, which is used as a very general catch-all term of, you know, something useful that you can use in some way. I think that what you actually see, however, in a lot of the practice of wargaming, and that is to say the reports that I am able to read, and I know that a lot of these reports cannot be seen, so this is not a general statement about all the reports that are being done, but it is a statement about a lot of the reports that are in the public square. So here I mean reports by organizations like CSIS, CFR, CNA, RAND, you know, the kind of wargaming reports you can find. They often report a bunch of other stuff. They report things like system outcomes. You know, you'll often read about how games ended. 8 times out of 12, China took Taiwan in the first week. These are statements not about decisions. These are statements about outcomes. They're often statements about how the system operated. These two weapon systems, when combined, did this effect. When they were not used, that didn't happen. If they couldn't bring allies in, then it wouldn't work. If they could, it would. Again, these are not statements about decisions. These are statements about system properties. They're often very narrative. They tell stories. And they very explicitly give you the whole story of what happened from start to finish. And very often, they identify causal processes. They sort of say, it is because these things work together in a particular way that something occurred, that something was triggered, some sort of event took place that would not have taken place had these things not anteceded it. These are statements about causal processes. Again, not statements about decisions. And I contend that when you read a lot of these reports, they're often talking about a lot of this stuff as well. They will talk about the stated set of things that war games will talk about decisions, but they'll often spend much time, or in some cases, most of the time, talking about these other things as well. And that's often the way they're used as forecasting tools, and I think that's the way they're sort of presented as forecasting tools. Forecasts about what they would happen in the future, not what would China decide to do on a particular afternoon. Furthermore, I think these are often the most compelling findings of war games. So this is not a criticism, it's an observation. If we think about a lot of the most famous war games in history, this is what they're doing, right? They're talking about, you know, the famous, obviously the very famous a naval war college, Navy Plan Orange, where from which the US Navy derived its own island hopping strategy that it then used in World War II. I mean, that's not just or even or mostly about decisions. It's also about how all these things interact to give you a, you know, first they kind of identify the system and then they start figuring out how to actually operate inside that system most efficiently, right? So it's really, the decisions are doing a very minor part of this. However, I would say that when you look at this kind of stuff, it's hard to reconcile that kind of reporting with the initial set of things that you're being presented as what wargaming strengths are, right? They're kind of said, you know, in a soft voice, right? It's not really said out loud, this is what we're really doing. In fact, in some instances, it's actively denied. So you'll see some wargaming scholars will move into a defensive crouch and say, no, we're just studying decisions, we're not just studying anything else, when they're kind of pushed into that corner. Who cares? Right? Who cares about this sort of stuff? Well, in some sense, nobody needs to care. The philosophy of science is something that most scientists don't care about. Right? Most scientists who are doing any kind of science don't especially care about where their knowledge claims come from. They go through graduate school, they're told this is how we make arguments in this discipline, you will make arguments in this discipline in this way. I have this conversation with my PhD students all the time. You know, as one of my professors said to me, political science is a discipline and you will be disciplined. You know, you're going to do it the way we do it because this is the way we do it. But in principle, somebody needs to know the answer to these questions. Somebody needs to know why the thing is credible or believable. And if you do go to a statistics book and crack it open at the front, somebody will lay out the assumptions of an OLS regression and explain to you exactly what claims they are making about reality before they run the test. And many students, and myself included, will go past those first few pages. They're highly confusing. It doesn't seem to make any sense. There's certainly nothing practical here. You're not going to use any of this in your statistical analysis. But it is there. They're saying, we're making these claims about reality. Now here's the models. And I don't think we're able to do that. And what we do then is we fall back on intuition and community norms, which is just not a robust enough standard. Now let's be a little bit more sort of practical about why this matters. If you have a skeptical sponsor or potential sponsor who starts saying, I'm not satisfied that this game is giving me what I need, it's harder to say, no, I'm sure it is, beyond saying, trust me, I've been doing this for a long time. Or everyone agrees this is the right way to do it, right? It's not an independent set of objective statements about the process. It's a statement about best practices and that should be sufficient. Also on the ethical dimension, as wargaming is increasingly getting picked up in the defense sector as an actual tool for planning or forecasting or evaluating, we should want to know with much more confidence about the statements we're making and the limits and the extensions of those claims. And so, as I say, and as a final point on this, the more we are able to really understand what we're doing, the better we can get at it, right? You know, statistics is a very good example of this, in which, you know, it starts with a very basic set of regressions, and then there's all these assumptions, and it's like, well, you know, these assumptions are probably being violated, and then what happens is a bunch of other statisticians say, well, we can come up with a bunch of tests to test whether or not these assumptions have been violated after we've run our test. You know, they're able to develop the method out from those initial statements so that it gets more and more refined and more robust, assuming you agree with the assumptions, right? You know, it's not going to convince everyone all the time, but it's at least able to stand on pretty stable footing. So that's the initial statement. So let's think then about what happens when we try to make wargaming more scientific, and then I'm going to try to reconcile what I just showed you with these statements. Now, I think one of the major problems that has recurred in these debates is that, you know, Peter Perler's book is a very good example of this. When he's talking about science, he's really talking about statistical science, right? He's talking about operations analysis and operations research. That's the kind of people he's having an argument with. And for what it's worth, in a lot of social science, that is also what people think they mean when they talk about science. They think they're talking about some version of statistics. And if it doesn't look like numbers and it doesn't look like statistics, it's not real science. And so this is what's typically known as causal inference theory testing, right? It's the logic of, do I claim there's a cause that's explaining an outcome? Is the cause present? Is it working as I thought it would work? Yes. There's a strong emphasis in this approach to science. This is the logic of experimentalism on, I did it in this experiment, therefore it will happen outside this experiment. That's explicitly the logic of the way AB drug testing works, right? In this lab, we gave 1,000 people a Smartie, we gave 1,000 people the drug. The people who took the drug got better, the people who got the Smartie didn't change, therefore the drug will have that effect. When we give it to all the people who weren't in this laboratory, all the next 10,000, hundreds of thousands, it's a statement about things happened here, they will also happen out there, right? So it's about making law-like generalizations. In order for that to work, just like A-B testing works in medical science, it has to be extremely stringent and extremely rigorous. You have to make sure you're reproducing the experiment identically every single time. It has to be the same for subject 1 and subject 998, or we have an internal validity problem. You're not actually running the same test. You need to make sure they're selected from a representative sample of the population, or you have an external validity problem. Whatever happens here may not happen out there. And you have to do it multiple times to be confident that you have not got a fluke and you have actually got the mean outcome, the mean effect of this cause on the mean population. It's extraordinarily demanding for you to be able to do this. And I'm sure many of you are aware of the social science versions of this in wargaming that are out there. And there's not very many because they're so demanding, but the most obvious examples are to look at the work of Andrew Reddy and his team on nuclear escalation, and Jackie Schneider and her team also on nuclear escalation. And what you see when you read those articles, you see very, very long and expensive projects where they ran the game 400 times. They had to have $1 million grant. It took 4 years to run it. And the questions are often extremely discreet. They're very, very basic. Would you go up or would you go down? If you're in this situation, I'd go up, experiment complete. That's the end of the game. So they're very kind of small games, and they have huge burdensome requirements in order to meet this standard. Furthermore, as many in this room know, they're completely disconnected from whatever it is that most professional wargamers are doing, in which most of those games usually have very looser rule sets. So the rules themselves will be only partially bound, or the activity will only be partially bound by a rigid set of rules. And at least in some places, there's going to be the possibility of players proposing novel lines of action, or adjudicators adjudicating on new things that hadn't been proposed or expected before the game began. In the language of validity, that's an internal validity problem. Game one is not the same as game two. And you know, even if you have the same participants, they're not the same, because the rules keep changing slightly. The adjudication process keeps changing slightly. Also, of course, as many people know, they have few iterations, or in some cases, just one iteration. You're just running it once. So from the statement of making law-like generalizations, this is what will happen in the outside world in the same situation, it's impossible to make a claim like that from one or two cases. Or it's not possible, but it's, you know, your standard error is so large that you're going to be very careful about what you're saying. However, this type of approach to science is not really what science is for many scientists. And what we have here is the kind of tyranny of statistics, which is a tyranny that also social science labors under. This is what's known as the behaviorist turn in the 1950s and 60s, where a lot of social science has shifted to statistical analysis as the be-all and end-all of scientific knowledge production. If you cannot turn it into statistics or something that's reconcilable with the logics I just laid out, it does not count. It is not knowledge, and you are not allowed to present it as such. That's the claim. It's, in fact, as Patrick Jackson notes in his book, The Conduct of Inquiry of International Relations, it's almost never the way most social science works. It usually doesn't meet these standards, but it claims to meet these standards. And so what it does is it essentially slashes away a whole bunch of other ways of possibly producing knowledge and says these ones don't count. It narrows all knowledge production to hypothesis testing. And that's it. Like, test a hypothesis, yes, no, and if no, discard your whole theory. Furthermore, it cannot explain wargaming success. Even if this was true, it still doesn't tell me how they figured out what the effective strategy would be for defeating the Japanese in World War II. Because whatever they did in the Naval War College, it wasn't any of this. It's not reconcilable with this logic. And so we have clearly got examples of games that succeeded in producing actionable knowledge, giving an accurate description of some sort of process or activity, but it didn't do it this way. So what did it do? So how do we make a claim that this is a knowledge production motor or method without reference to this? Well, I think what we do here is we cast the aperture much more widely and think much more seriously about alternative ways of thinking about the types of findings and knowledge that war games can or do or might produce, and expand out what we actually think is going on sometimes. And I want to just give some examples here that are reconcilable what I think you often see in war games, including the war games that I've designed and run in my own experience. We have what is known in case study analysis as single case analysis. You're looking at a single case, and you're just looking at the properties of that single case to try to explain why that case ended the way it did. Not why all cases ended the way they did, why this case ended the way they did. That's a murder trial. That's how a murder trial works. Right? They don't say this is how all murders work. They said this is how this murder worked. This murder had this sequence of events that took place, and you, the jury, should believe that this is the explanation for this outcome. I think war games are sometimes doing this. Do I know what would happen in the event of a war between country A and country B? I don't know. But in this synthetic war of country A and country B, this is the process through which it happened. Will this be the average process? I don't know. I don't need to make that claim. But I can make the claim that in this case, I think it is what happened. And you should believe that in this case it was true, and that itself might be instructive to you, because you might have some of the initial conditions that country A had. And you might think, well, we've got some of those initial conditions, and if country B made all the same decisions, maybe we'd end up in the same place. Maybe you wouldn't. That's still knowledge, right? That's still useful, as long as you narrow the scope and say, that's the claim I'm making. I'm not making bigger claims than that. These are the claims I'm making. These types of approaches require a very strong focus on the empirics and the narrative, right? You've got to really make sure you've got all those pieces correct and you're able to tell that story correctly in order to be able to identify the critical causal variables. Again, a murder case is very instructive here. Murder cases, single case analysis does not work on the logic of frequentism, which is the logic of statistics. I've got 10,000 examples of this, therefore it's the cause. In fact, the classic thing in a murder case is what? A smoking gun. A single piece of evidence might be sufficient on its own to explain the entirety of the events that you've seen. These kinds of ways of thinking about what you might be doing in a game might be sufficient. The game identifies a single thing. It says, in this case, this one thing was absolutely determinative in this game. That's worth paying attention to. You know, in this game, the United States did not join the war. And if it did not join the war in this game, it all went south. Does that mean it would always go all south every time? We don't know. But that's what happened in this game. I think here, if we're looking for something a little bit more general, we can think about the discovery of causal mechanisms. This is essentially theory building. It's one way that you can use cases, a limited number of cases, to build a theoretical finding. The finding here is not empirical. The finding here is theoretical. You identify causal mechanisms, how different factors come together to generate outcomes. Now, I'm happy to have the squabble with somebody very publicly here. I don't think stats can do this ever. I don't think statistics is capable of making causal mechanism analysis. It can just keep identifying constant conjunctions. It can be more and more complicated about identifying constant conjunctions. But for you to state that this interacts with this in that way is a theoretical statement, not an empirical one, or not entirely an empirical one. You have to work the theory out to be able to make the claims about the evidence. And so what you could be doing here in games is you could be identifying how a particular set of factors came together to generate an unusual outcome. I can give you, I'm conscious of time, so please, I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm going over, but I'll give you a very quick personal example because I was told there's somebody today on the train on the way in. Aaron Beam here is in the corner. He was our sponsor of the war game that we built for NATO ACT a couple of years ago, Horizons. In our first iteration of Horizons, we built a game called Sleepwalkers, which was a massive seminar game. Brought in a bunch of experts on US foreign policy, NATO, the EU, China, climate change, trade, a bunch of SMEs in a room, kind of what was going to happen over the next 20 years. Very kind of open game. What we're trying to do is, for us, is we're ultimately trying to build a rigid game. We're trying to get a sense of what are the key factors we should be aware of. In that game, at one point, the US team recognized Taiwanese independence in, you know, circa 2033 or something. Why did they recognize Taiwanese independence? In this game, it was because South Korea had gone nuclear in the previous turn, and the United States wanted to send a signal to the remainder of the allies in the region that it was not worth going nuclear. The US could be trusted, and to prove their commitment to their allies in the region, they were going to recognize Taiwan. What they'd identified here was it a likely causal mechanism? No. But was it a plausible causal mechanism? The SMEs in the room, the subject matter experts in the room were like, yeah, that could happen. They'd identified a causal route towards Taiwanese, US recognition of Taiwanese independence that certainly I'd never considered before. I now have two causal routes in my head. One is somebody attacks Taiwan. The other route is maybe sufficient security conditions in the region force the United States to feel like they have to do it to signal commitment. You get the point I'm trying to make here, right? For me, that was a really interesting and useful finding that was generated inside the process of the game, and that I don't think any of the people in the room beforehand would have expected to have seen. If you said, do you think Taiwan would be recognized under any condition? I suspect most of them would have said no. It came out of the game. Now, what's useful about this is that unlike empirical generalizations, which require you to have lots of cases and controlled studies, causal mechanisms don't have that requirement. You can identify a causal mechanism in one or two or three discrete cases and then say, okay, this is a process which we might think will happen in other cases with similar conditions. It's not actually a requirement for you to prove that it does exist in a wider population for you to prove that it makes sense, because the proof of it making sense is demonstrated in the cases. Does that make sense? So you can identify these things in the war game and say, look, as long as these initial conditions are met, we think you can expect to see the following types of processes. I think this is what's happening very often in war games, and I think this is something that war games can sell as what you're getting out of it, is you're getting to see the world in a particular way. The other thing you can do here is it's another form of modeling. It's a slightly different form of modeling. You can collect empirical generalizations or facts into single frameworks for generating classification schemes, right? And this is what often happens when people are doing other kinds of research, right? You get a bunch of research together and you start figuring out, hang on, actually, I think I've got four types or five types. So war games could be used in that way as well. You can sort of say, well, we've seen all this stuff going on. We can now identify a number of strategy profiles or a number of, you know, what we might consider, you know, trustworthy allies or whatever it is. You can use it to start to categorize the social world. I've got empirical there with an asterisk because, of course, all the data is synthetic. But in principle, it's working the same logic as organizational modeling in case studies. Now, my claim here is that these approaches reflect a lot of the wargaming as it's practiced much more than claims about, you know, we ran this game and this is what China's going to do in the real world. Very often, it's often as at least as well talking about these kinds of things, and being conscious of that would be useful. The other point here is the payoffs are theoretical much more than they are empirical. You're making arguments about models and processes that you think exist in the world, not about events, you know, not about empirical phenomena, but rather roots to empirical phenomena, right? Aggregations of empirical phenomena. It's a different kind of payoff. It's a very real kind of payoff. That's E equals MC squared, right? The value of Einstein was the theory, not the empirics, right? Nobody really cares that it was proved, actually by studies that were done before he demonstrated that, except that they proved that he was right, right? The payoff, theoretical physics, the payoff is the theory. You know, the experimental physics is just there to evaluate whether or not the theory is useful or not. But the hard bit, the real work, the stuff that we're really interested in, is the first bit. It's the theory bit. It's not the experimental bit. So what happens when, if we expand wargaming in this way, and I'll try to be reasonably summary here because so we can have a Q&A, I think one of the things we can do is you can better defend your findings to your sponsor, right? You can feel, I mean, this is a really important thing. I talk to Evan, I talk to my PhD students, I have this conversation with myself. When you're doing research, is, you know, scoping, knowing really clearly what you are on the hook for explaining and knowing what you're not on the hook for explaining. So that when somebody puts up their hand and says, oh yeah, well, you said this causes that, well, what causes the cause? You say, I don't know. That's not what I said my study was about. I said X causes Y, I identified X's, I measured them. I don't know where they came from. That's not what I said I was doing. It makes you more able to know where you are making claims and not making claims, which I think can make you more convincing to any potential sponsor of that work, that you can actually say with much more confidence, I know exactly what I'm doing, or know exactly what I'm trying to do, and therefore when you sort of say, well, I don't think this is empirically generalizable, you can say, I agree. Rather than kind of go, well, no, maybe it is, you just go, I've never even tried to do that, that was never my purpose. I think you can have improved reporting, because you recognize what you're looking for inside the game might vary from game to game. You might be looking for an organizational model, which means that's the kind of stuff you want to get out of your deliberative data. You're looking for causal processes. One way of thinking about this with causal processes, for example, is decisions matter less. Decisions only matter if they're triggering causal processes. Otherwise, they're actually largely irrelevant data. What really matters is recording the causal processes. That's the data you want to record. And the deliberative data you'd want to record is the adjudicator's explanations as to why those causal processes are taking place. It's a different kind of data you're trying to net out of the game, and you can actually discount a whole bunch of other data that would be much more important if you were, for example, trying to understand why people are making decisions. So it can actually tidy up your reports and help you know where to expand and where to cut, because as probably many of you know, a lot of wargaming reports run to 150, 200 pages. And I think part of that emerges from the fact that they're kind of reporting everything because there's a little bit of uncertainty about what is actually the key thing that they should be reporting. I think, furthermore, when you start to think this way, you start to see the limits of these analogies and the limits of the use, for example, this is all logic of different ways of using case studies. It starts to help me, for example, as a researcher, see, okay, that's good, but there's other stuff going on in war games that normal case study research doesn't do. And so you get a better sense of the uniqueness of the method. I think one of the really unique things about wargaming is it can be generative of strategies. I'm not aware of any other method that does this, right? Some other methods will look at decisions, but here active strategies, a combination of decisions based on sort of prior decisions and terrain and topography, whatever else, that's a very unique type of finding. And you know, my kind of, personally for me, my kind of realization of that was because I started to see, well, no other method I can see does this, right? It's precisely by trying to nail down what it's doing that I could start to see that it's doing things that I don't understand. I think another important part which is strongly affecting my research at the moment is the way that you have war games that are models that are kind of objective. You know, you have your board in front of you and your cards, and that's the kind of objective model out there, but then everyone's also bringing their subjective models, and a lot of what's going on in this knowledge production is this interaction between that how it primes you to think about certain things in here and think in certain ways. I'm not quite sure exactly what all of that means, but that's not like other methods either. That's not exactly how surveys work. They do have a little bit of priming, but I don't think it's anything like this. What are some of the constraints for this? Well, it might be the case that different forms of study require different case study selections. You know, instead of being, you can be a little bit more precise. I mean, in fact, I would say you'd be obliged to be more precise about exactly why you're picking this scenario in this setting, because you think this one's going to be useful for producing this kind of theoretical finding, but it would be bad at producing this other kind. So rather than kind of we want to do all of these things, you say much more clearly, I want to do one or two of these things. It might also give us a way of identifying meta-theoretical purposes rather than just purposes. Something that emerged out of me doing this work was I hadn't really thought seriously about how very often the purpose of the work of a war game is often stated very similarly to the way a research question is stated in social science. I want to understand, you know, by studying this war, I want to understand how wars break out, right? That's a kind of a statement of, you know, I've got an abstract question that's being represented by an empirical question. But there's also a higher question than that, which is, you know, in general, right? I want to understand how wars are breaking out in general. That's a meta-theoretical goal. Or I want to understand the exact processes that cause wars to escalate. That's a meta-theoretical purpose about causal processes. So this is kind of getting us to this next level of putting purpose in the language of abstract purpose, not just the specific purpose. This specific game, what is its abstract purpose? Is its abstract purpose or theoretical purpose is to produce a particular kind of outcome. It will also require much more conscious theoretical grounding in the lead-up game, but I think much more importantly, conscious theoretical analysis post-game. How can you interpret the evidence? And what here you need SMEs as part of the interpretive scheme of the evidence, that they look at all the data and say, oh, do you know what I see here? I see four existing models we already have of, I don't know, why wars transform into something more violent or why countries misspend their, you know, they already have a knowledge of a variety of different models, so then when they're looking at the data, they can identify which of this is truly novel and which of this is actually, we already know this story. This is a story we've told before, but they might also say, oh, what's interesting here is some activity took place that is not reconcilable with our theoretical knowledge of these events. You've identified something new. This might be a novel way of us understanding a problem. And we have to be very careful here that everyone knows the limits of their knowledge, right? Our temptation is to think we're all, well, I can do that bit myself. I can analyze international relations research and, to a lesser extent, wargaming. Full stop. If you put anything else in front of me, I'll say I'm not expert enough to analyze this data. You know, I can come up with best guesses. I might do a lot of amateur reading around this, but you have to be careful to have the analysts to truly know how to look at this kind of data. Now, I just want to very quickly kind of give a, and I can come back to this in the Q&A, but this is kind of a very unstructured initial thoughts about this, how this shakes out for different types of studies, how you would care more about, well, what kind of scenario should I select? You know, if it's a organizational model, I want to select a scenario that I think will be truly illuminating. I have a priori, I think this is going to, by just this setting and scenario alone, I expect there to be a lot of unusual activity and novel stuff. If it's a strategy game, I might want the scenario to be the average typical scenario that we think they're going to face under these kind of circumstances. How much do the SMEs matter in these kinds of games? Where do they matter more or less? What kinds of design do we want to be, you know, what's more suitable for this type of theoretical finding? And then also, what do we care more about in the report? What should we be making sure in both in the decap and the capture of the data and in the reporting of the data, what is it we really want to tell a story about to the reader? What do we want to say, hey, look, this is about causal processes. I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about, you know, the seven triggering conditions for this type of activity or this type of event, and I'm not going to spend nearly as much time about the overall narrative of the game. That might just get two pages, so you kind of get a sense of, okay, this was the game, overall this is what happened, let's get into the detail. Whereas if you're doing an SCA, that narrative is actually critical. That whole story is the report. You've got to tell the story in detail. But what this would let you do is, would let you not have to do both. And it would turn 30 or 40 or 50 pages of reporting into 15 or 20 because you're focusing on the key thing you're looking for and you're not going to let yourself get distracted by the other things. Okay, I'm going to leave that there for the Q&A. These are some of the references that motivated some of my thinking around this. So I'll just sit there while we're chatting, and I have some other slides I can go to if we need it. But I'm very happy to take some questions in the limited time we have left.
15 minutes.
15 minutes.